everyone, and welcome back to Malice in the Mitten. This is season one, episode two. I am your host, Tracy Preston, along with my bestie, Christine Mulligan. Hey, Christine.
Hey, Tracy. I'm ready to get into this one. I'm not sure if I'm liking the theme of the things that you send me for us to talk about, but it's kind of interesting. Let's just go with it.
Okay, we're going to get into it. This is a story of Christopher Dankovich, a boy who committed parricide. So now let's imagine you are a 15-year-old boy and you find yourself getting interested in some pretty heavy issues that are going on in society. These issues are actually still going on to this very day. And I'm talking about a woman's right to have an abortion. You make the decision that this is an abomination. Your newfound deep religious beliefs are consuming you that women are killing their innocent babies. Every day, all day, these feelings are growing more intense and you can't stop thinking about it. And every day your angst is building against these women who are getting abortions, towards physicians that are performing abortions and facilities where they are performed. And of course, let's not forget towards anyone who is in support of women and their right to choose to have an abortion. So what is a 15-year-old boy to do? Well, Christopher decided that he was going to make a stand. He started diving into the world of research on the internet. But before we get into what he did, let's dial it back a little bit. Diane O'Connor married James Dankovich in 1989 and later that year gave birth to their one and only son, Christopher. During their marriage, they purchased the cabin, which is located near Twin Lakes in Muskegon County. Now, just a little side note, Twin Lakes is where I went all through high school for band camp. So I was like, what? This is up in Twin Lakes? Okay, I know this area.
Did you just say that's where you went to band camp?
I did. I was totally at band camp.
I love that I have a best friend that we can sit around where you're going to say to me one time at band camp. I'm sorry. That was a sidebar.
So just 6 years into their marriage, Diane and James amicably ended their marriage. Christopher was 6 years old. As most divorces go when children are involved, one parent will request to have primary custody over the other. It was Diane who was awarded primary custody of their son, and James was awarded the cabin. After the divorce, Diane changed her last name to Michelle, which is a little bit of a mystery because that's not her maiden name at all, and I don't know why she did that. Diane and James lived relatively close to one another. Diane and Christopher resided in Rochester Hills, and James lived approximately 8 miles away from them. Christopher would spend the usual set weekends and a set weekday with his dad. Then the rest of the time, he would be with Diane. Christopher's father remarried, and he had another child, but this time he had a daughter. Diane did not remarry. It was just her and Christopher together, and things seemed to be going per usual, the divorced family, you know, doing the best they can to raise their son. Both of Christopher's parents were accomplished people. James was a chiropractor, and Diane was, get this, she has a lot of stuff going on here. Diane was a social worker, a counselor, a hypnotherapist, a minister, so here's where we get the religion coming in, and she also had a master's degree in counseling. The next handful of years were pretty uneventful, but that was all about to change. Christopher, now 15 years old and a freshman at Rochester Adams High School, was a good student. He was on the honor roll, but his mother started to see a change in him. Christopher now had a girlfriend, which Diane was not particularly fond of, and he was starting to get a little bit rebellious. Like most kids his age, he was trying to define who he was and what he believed in. Christopher had dyed his hair blue, he was sneaking out at night, watching pornography on his computer, and was also frequently visiting some sort of weapons websites. It was from these websites that he learned how to build a gun out of PVC pipe. Not only did he make the gun, but it was also at the ready loaded with gunpowder and marbles. His mother found it and immediately took the gun and handed it over to his father.
Can we just talk about how scarily ingenious this kid kind of was, though?
Yeah.
And if directed in another way, I mean, what a different story we'd be talking about. Well, maybe not on this channel, but yeah, it would be a totally different story.
Yeah.
So
the things he could do.
Just wanted to point out that this kid was pretty ingenious.
Yeah. So religion was a part of Christopher's life as his mother was a minister, but he was becoming deeply religious and felt that he was called upon by God as a servant to kill abortionists, child molesters, and even U.S. Senator John Kerry. So why John Kerry? Perhaps it was because he supports a woman's right to choose. Along with taking that handmade gun, Diane had also taken Christopher's computer. As she trolled through what he was doing, she began to discover that they had a much larger problem on their hands. On Saturday, April 23rd, 2005, Christopher was staying the night at his father's home in Troy. Sometime during the night or in the wee hours of Sunday morning, Christopher cut a hole in the screen of his second floor bedroom window and shimmied his way down to the ground. Once out of the house, he made his way to a school in Bloomfield Hills and attempted to break in. I'm assuming that since he no longer had a phone, if he had had one, he certainly didn't have his computer. Maybe he thought, you know, hey, this is a way to get a hold of my girlfriend or get access to the internet. Needless to say, Christopher's attempts to break into the school was not successful. The police soon arrived and took him into custody. James, his father, was contacted, and Christopher was released to his father early that Sunday morning. But later that day on Sunday, April 24th, 2005, James took Christopher back to his mother's home. James, Diane, and Christopher sat down to talk about what was going on with him, and I'm assuming consequences for his recent actions. In the articles that I read, there were no details on how that conversation went, but I'm sure with a mother who had a strong background in counseling that it was probably a pretty calm discussion. Certainly something that wouldn't have gone down in my house. I would have been yelled at pretty bad.
I don't know. See, I see it differently. Just because she was a counselor, what you do outside of your home is totally different than what you do inside of your home. Mm. So I'm going to play devil's advocate on that one a little bit. And it might have been a little bit insane. Like, Diane might have been off the chain with Christopher. And this is complete guesstimation. But it's like when we're nurses and we do our thing with our patients, we're super diligent with them and super careful with them and baby them and coddle them. When one of our kids falls and scrapes their knee, we're like, are you dying? You're not dying. Go wash it off, put a band-aid on, get outside. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So I don't know. I mean, you always like to think the best of everybody at first, but maybe Diane like lost her marbles on him a little bit. I'm just saying.
Oh, you know what? I think you know what? You could be right. She probably did lose her marbles.
She was like, what the hell is wrong with you? Probably not very counselor-y. I'm just saying.
She probably wasn't very counselor-y.
And that's why we don't hear about it, because she's not going to cop to that, for sure.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, I wondered how he handled it, too. Was he calm all the while brewing up his revenge, what he was going to do? How, you know, he was just going to, yeah, I'll take it from you now, but you're going to get it later, kind of a thing. So,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, after all, it was his mom that found the gun. It was his mom who took his electronics away. And it was his mother who turned the gun over to his father. So I'm sure he was absolutely pissed off about that. After their family discussion, James left for home. Later that Sunday evening, James tried to call the home of Diane and Christopher, but he was unable to reach anyone after multiple attempts. James then reached out and called Diane's mother. Now, I have a problem with this. Like, this is your son. What are you doing calling your ex-wife's mother to handle some business for you?
That's how it goes.
Yeah, right? So he explained that he was having a difficult time getting anyone to answer the phone at the house and expressed his concern. I imagine he told Diane's mother about what was going on with Christopher, about the discussion they had had that evening with their son and his recent change in behavior. James had asked Diane's mother if she would go over and check on both Diane and Christopher. I also wonder if he told her about the homemade gun. What if there was another weapon that Christopher had? Why would you want to involve this woman? Was he scared of what he would find and didn't want to find it himself? Christine, what do you think about that?
Grateful and thankful that my children have never had anything ludicrous as this happen in their lives. But they've done some silly things that they do. They get talked to about it, maybe punished a little bit or whatever, and then we forget about it.
That is a major problem.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, maybe he had a bunch of other little monotonous stuff that, you know, maybe it was his blue hair that really was setting them off.
Right.
And they complained about his blue hair more than they complained about time you made a gun out of a bunch of gadgets and marbles.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and, you know, try to break into places that weren't as big and as public as school. Maybe he was like a serial break-in artist. Maybe he was a klepto.
Right, right. That's a good take on it. Well, I'll tell you what, Diane's mother did go and check on them. but it wasn't until the next day on Monday. She arrived at 3160 Palmare Drive and entered the home. She found her daughter lying on the floor, barely covered by a tarp. In all, Diane had been stabbed over 100 times. She had stab wounds in her back, chest, heart, neck, and face. But the carnage didn't end there. Both of Diane's eyes had been stabbed out to the point that her eyes were completely out of her eye sockets and lying on her face. She had also suffered blunt force head trauma. According to the Daily Oakland Press, police had found a folding knife with blood and hair on it. Now, the only folding knife that I can think of would be like a pocket knife, something that, you know, Christopher could have easily had in his pocket or hidden somewhere that Diane couldn't find it when she was going through her room. They had seen drops of blood in the house and blood in the sink. And when people commit stabbings, they tend to get cuts on the palm of their hand. And this happens because there's blood everywhere. It's super viscous, which means it's thick and slippery, which causes the hand to lose its grip. And with each continued forceful stab, the hand will slide down the blade, causing cuts on the palm of the dominant hand. But the one thing they couldn't find was Christopher, and Diane's white Astro van was also missing, and on her van was a personalized license plate that read, "Love for you." Police assumed that Christopher had taken his mother's vehicle after the killing. When they spoke with James, Christopher's father, he said that he had a cabin up north, and since he didn't know where his son was and that Diane's van was missing, it would make sense that Christopher would go there for a safe place to get away. Christopher did take his mother's van, and he did go to the cabin in St. Helens, which was approximately 100 miles north from where he lived. Upon arriving to the cabin, officers immediately spotted Diane's white Astro van with a personalized license plate. They positioned themselves for a possible standoff, although this is not what they were hoping for. They had seen what Christopher was capable of doing to his own mother, so anything at this point was possible. But to everyone's surprise, Christopher did walk out and surrender, and no one was hurt. When he came out of the cabin, Christopher no longer had a head full of blue hair. He was now completely bald. Once they had Christopher in their custody, the police searched the cabin. They came upon a bag that Christopher had packed. It was something of a survival bag, which contained both military and survival gear. Christopher's plan was to head south to lay low for a while, but where south he was going was not found in the materials that I read for the episode. At the time Christopher brutally attacked and killed his mother, he was just 15 years old and he was charged as an adult. The judge wanted to make sure that Christopher understood everything that was happening and what the sentencing meant. He acknowledged that he did understand. In the end, Christopher received a minimum of 25 years in prison. At his sentencing, Christopher did say that he was sorry for what he had done. From the article in the Oakland Press, the judge spoke to James, the father of Christopher. He expressed his condolences to the family, but said he has a job to do, and that job is to sentence Christopher for the murder of his mother. The judge expressed his frustration toward understanding how Christopher could have done something like this. He was, prior to the murder of his mother, what seemed to be a decent citizen, a model student at school, and yet he committed such a vicious crime against his mother by repeatedly stabbing her over 100 times, including her eyes. The judge said, quote,
"That's what concerns me. I just can't see any good reason for this. If you did this once, why wouldn't you do this again?"
And Christopher replied, quote,
"I'm not a violent person."
The judge then responded by saying, quote,
"That's what makes this case so bizarre."
At sentencing, the judge strongly recommended that Christopher receive mental health treatment. But for some reason, the judge also mentioned that he cannot order the help, but can only strongly recommend it. And I can't understand that. Why is it that a judge can't order that this kid gets deep psychiatric help that he needs while he's incarcerated? I mean, does that make any sense to you?
I mean, when he's trying him as an adult and because of the case, maybe that's a legal thing that we can't quite understand, but I do know that there's a big difference if he's going to criminally charge him and send him to jail, then he can't order psychiatric help. But if they, like, plea, you know, maybe some of our listeners can comment back to us and tell us more about this if they know more of the legal side, quite honestly, because that's probably what it was, is that he couldn't order it because they were going to try him criminally and send him to prison. If he was going to order psychiatric care, then that would lend to that he wasn't really guilty. I don't know enough about that to be able to speak to that intelligently. But when I read that, that's what I was thinking. It's criminal versus psychiatric.
Right. They can do one, but they can't do both.
One or the other, not both. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel that this is the reason why there's so much recidivism when prisoners are released back into society, right? People are put in prison, absolutely, right? They're put in prison for serious crimes such as murder, rape, pedophilia, but they are just put in a cell and they are not getting the therapy that they truly need. And without treatment, they will not have the tools necessary to help them cope with their real life issues and struggles while they're back out in society. So I think that's just something that really needs to be fixed.
Yeah, well, I also think that's a way bigger conversation, though, because where do we get the money to get all this psychiatric help for all these people that keep going back to prison?
Yeah, well, due to Christopher's age, he was housed with minors until he reached the age of 21. He was then transferred to Michigan's Thumb Correctional Center. His current earliest date of release could be April 24th, 2030, which oddly enough would be the 25th anniversary of his mother's slaying, and he would be 41 years old. While in prison, Christopher does a lot of writing and also teaches high school level classes to other inmates. He writes on a blog called Prison Writers, where prisoners have a voice. What I'm going to read to you next is Christopher Dankovich's bio in his own words. Quote,
I was just 15 years old when I got locked up. I recently completed 8th grade in Rochester Hills, Michigan. I was 16 years old when I was sentenced to a minimum of 25 years in prison for second-degree murder. Two of my redeeming qualities from back then were that I was an honor roll student and pretty good at photography. I was a good kid in a bad situation who became a scared kid that wanted to save the world or at least get away from the person who made me hate it. I spent 10 years in prison and I've grown into someone I'm now proud to be. I still have a minimum of 15 years left to serve, which is the same number of years I lived on the outside. Since my incarceration, I've earned the equivalent of a high school diploma, an associate degree, taught high school level math and social studies for 5 years, took a culinary arts trade class, and have helped teach it for a year now. I've learned basic carpentry skills, how to draw, play guitar, design and create leather belts and purses, started to learn Hebrew and Spanish before that was stopped. My dream is to someday become a professional writer or designer. My hope for prisonwriters.com is that it can bring attention and hopefully reform to the incarceration of children as adults across the United States.
Below that bio was some additional information. Quote, Chris Dankovich is a tutor, a teacher, a writer, and an artist who has been incarcerated for the past 10 years since he was 15 years old. Chris Dankovich is serving 25 to 37 years in Michigan for murdering his mother when he was 15 years old. He has previously won a Penn and a Vidalia Press Award for writing and has been published by the Harvard Educational Review, the Periphery Magazine, and has been accepted by the Fence Magazine. So, if we go back to the conversation that we just had that they can't afford for them to be receiving psychiatric care, how in the hell do they afford for them to do all these classes, get his associate's degree, cook?
I know. That's what I mean. That's like the slippery slope whenever you talk about incarceration and how wrong it is and how we treat them like animals, you know, on some sides of perception, right? And then you have the other people that are like, lock them up, throw the key away. You know, then we have the other people that are like, death sentences for everybody would be fine. And then you have the people trying to help some prisoners, but not all prisoners. It's like, where do we draw the line? I mean, it's just the legal system is kind of a little bit broke all around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talked about that last episode.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they weren't rich, they may have fully gotten away with it forever if somebody didn't get back at them. That's why I made the ending up in my own brain for the mother of the last episode we had. But getting back to this episode, I mean, this kid goes on to do all of these things and he lives a life, period, lives a life. Since she was a counselor, it might have been all sunshines and roses, the conversation that they had. But the thing is, I mean, she had to be some kind of something for him to feel that kind of way. Yes. Could it have been psychological? Could he have psychiatric things? Yeah. But we're never going to know. So I find it interesting that you can tell this story, just tell the story as it is. And you're still going to have, you know, 5 different versions of how it could have, should have, would have.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I find that really interesting. So the same thing goes for incarceration. We should have, could have, would have as a society, but it's so structurally broke at this point because some people are going to hear this and they're going to be like, oh, okay, so he was in prison, but then you just told me that he successfully did all these things. And you know what? Down around the corner from downtown where I live, family there for the past 5 years, their kids don't look like they're doing a bunch of nothing. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And their parents are still sitting on the side of the road with a sign. Do you know what I mean? So life is not fair anywhere, anyhow you shake it. But there's always going to be plenty to talk about, especially when it comes to incarceration. But he still never described why he did what he did, other than to say that she made him hate this life.
Yeah, like what?
I mean, am I wrong on that? Did he go into any detail anywhere else?
Nope, nothing. And I read several articles and it was just no elaboration whatsoever. And I found it interesting that, you know, in his bio, it's like he's blaming it on his mother. He was a good kid in a bad situation. Never really said that, yeah, I'm in prison for committing second degree murder. But he never seems to me had the balls to say that it was his mother that he murdered, right?
Yeah, and and you just touched on a really good point. He never took ownership of it.
Right.
He still blamed it on his mom.
Yeah. Yep.
So all this time, all these things that he's doing with his flourishing little life behind bars, I mean, he's got a bio for Christ's sakes.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's very published. It just is mind-blowing to me, all that he's been able to do while he's been there. I mean, he's clearly a very intelligent person, but my God, to have that type of violence within him, it wasn't like a couple stabs. So if it was a folded knife, I'm thinking pocket knife, right? That's not a big knife. Man, he was up in his mom's face, up close and personal, and he just went nuts. Yeah. Not only did he stab her eyes out, he also hit her in the head with something. She had blunt head force trauma.
Right. And then he literally says in court, not too long ago, you mentioned how the quote said, he said, I'm not a violent person, but yet I was able to stab the woman who birthed me 100 times and gouge her eyes out. Was he saying he doesn't think that's violence? Or was he trying to say he was possessed of some kind and he doesn't remember what happened? Like, I don't get it.
Yeah, no, he never.
Years later, he quadruples down and says, you know, that woman that made me hate life.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I'm a sucker. I'm an empath.
Mm-hmm.
And that was vicious AF.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, exactly. And to be 15 years old, I really struggle with that just horrific amount of violence that he unleashed on his mom. He was 15. He was just a baby boy.
Well, he was a hormone-raged being at the point.
Yeah.
So it doesn't shock me that he could be so passionately violent at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It shocks me that it was so very violent. And then a few years later, he's kind of boasting about what he has accomplished,
mm-hmm.
and still blaming it on his mother.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my sympathy, empathy train long gone for this kid.
I agree with you.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I just wonder, to be honest, I think he's in a safe place. Where, hey, his mom's not there anymore. He's in prison. He's adjusted. He's taking classes. He's bettering himself, all this good stuff. But it just makes me think that this deep, dark demon is just laying dormant. And if this kid ever gets out, I don't know how he could ever. The kid's got no skills. He doesn't know how to cope. How is he going to, you know, if he ever does get a girlfriend, what kind of lies is he going to have to tell about who he is, what he is, what he's done? Oh, and then the girlfriend breaks up with him. Then what?
That's another whole dark road. Yeah.
Right. But I can see it. This kid should never get out of prison, ever. In my opinion. And here's another thing that I find appalling. So we have our kids. We immediately love our kids. It's you do anything to save them, protect them, love them, right? Well, while Christopher was, you know, making his appearances in court, the grandmother that found her daughter, the father, everybody stood behind this kid.
That leads me to think more about the mom. I mean, we don't know. Like, this kid doesn't ever talk about his mom directly. And in your research, what kind of characterizations of her were the other people giving? Was she really hard? Was she the violent one? You know what I mean? And then this kid snapped?
No.
I don't know. Now you're piquing my interest in whether or not I am supposed to feel a little bit bad for him. What if he was abused all this time? That completely changes the whole conversation again.
It does. It would add a twist to it. But no, there was never anything that said anything negative about this woman at all. The mother of Diane said that she would love and support him and stand by him because that's what Diane would want.
So guilt. Diane's gone now, so there's no backing her, so they're going to back the next best thing. That kind of makes my skin crawl a little bit because mm-hmm. that speaks to the way in society that we back people because we know them or love them instead of really looking at the whole picture for the betterment of everyone around you. Because if you're going to know and and love this 15-year-old violent boy, and you're going to speak for the fact that he's not violent, even though catastrophically violent acts, then where are we as a society going to hold them responsible for kind of pulling the wool over our eyes?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I don't even know if I'm saying that right, but you know what I mean? Like, what if he did get out? What if he did get, I guess there's a mountain of what ifs.
Yeah.
That they all jumped behind him and said that, you know, and were vying for him to get a light sentence or vying for him to get maybe get psychiatric help instead of prison or, you know, get charged as a minor and then be out in a few years. Like, that's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
That makes me want to know more about Diane.
Yeah.
But like you're saying, they made it look all peachy and rosy. But then again, that's how a lot of people do it. The way we are in society is it's all about appearances.
Yeah.
Even after something like this.
Yeah.
And that's a whole nother podcast, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Like people you gotta own your stuff and you gotta be real. Mm-hmm. You gotta be real. Like,
yeah.
This kid 100 times and gouged her eyes out.
Yeah.
It was a horrible, horrible scene. Come on. We're going to say that he deserves a smack on the wrist or whatever they were going for. Like, what were they going for? What were they saying?
I don't know.
How were they supporting him?
Right. And this, from what I could tell, I think this kid really just pleaded guilty. There was no trial. Like, he did it. It was obvious he did it. And he just basically was in holding for like a year before he was 16 when he was finally sentenced. But it's interesting because I thought I would find a lot more information about Diane and the family dynamics, and who knows, maybe this kid was just, maybe he was just highly intelligent. Who knows? Maybe there's some crazy weird shit that was happening with this kid since he was little. I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's always something to that highly intelligent aspect. There's always like a fine line between love and hate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with intelligence. There's a fine line where you're just a psychopath. Or you're a genius. Do you know what I mean? Like, look at all the serial killers in the past. Like, most of them had very high IQs.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were very intelligent. And that's how they got away with what they did for so long.
Until
they didn't. Because it is super interesting to dive into the psyche of the people that do these atrocious things. Do you know, like, humans, we're all kind of like just ticking time bombs, it seems sometimes. It's a little scary.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to think that even the people that do these horrible things before they do them, most of them, of course, we have some psychopaths out there that this is the way they always are. You know, they're killing little animals when they're kids, and they just graduate to bigger and better things as they get older, or so they think.
Mm-hmm.
I say this kind of tongue in cheek, but you know what I mean. It's super interesting. The line gets a little blurry in between while they're doing what they're doing. But this kid didn't have any premeditative things other than innocuous things. Like, I don't even know if I appreciate the whole dyeing his hair blue. Not that I'm a fan of, you know, the multicolored hair. Like, I wouldn't have let my kids do it. Some kids dye their hair blue and they're perfectly great kids. They're just expressing themselves, you know? But for this one, like, that was one of the things that they could point out that something was awry with this kid. Like, this is a crazy story that he just seemingly went from normal to batshit crazy.
Yeah. If for any chance you are interested in reading any of Christopher's many penned articles, you can find them online by going to prisonwriters.com and then search Chris Dankovich. And that is the story of Christopher Dankovich, the 15-year-old boy who committed parricide of his mother.
So last time, Trace, we talk about kids getting murdered. And this time, Trace, we're talking about kids doing the murdering. What are we going to get up to next time?
Adult on adult.
Okay. That's good. That's good for us to change it up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. No kids next time, I promise.
Good, good.
All right, everybody. Well, that wraps up our show for today. Thank you so much for joining Malice in the Mitten. We look forward to seeing you next Malice Monday. Have a great day. See you soon.
Talk soon.
Bye.